None of these changes work, by the way, in terms of, you know, separating her from her history, but she becomes Lana Peters. And so, you know, you can kind of see that as a metaphor, obviously, for her repeated attempts to continue to distance herself. Right. You know, taking her mother's name was particularly important to her because her mother died when she was six, and she had no memory of ever being held by her mother. Her mother was not a maternal person by all accounts. And she had a photograph that she kept to the end of her life of her mother holding her as an infant. And she kept it as proof that her mother had loved her. Mm. But the only true memory she ever had of her mother was of her mother drawing a square over her chest, over Svetlana's chest, and pointing into it and saying, "That is where you must bury your secrets."
Oh, my God.
You know, in fact, she was raised by her nanny, her nurse, Alexandra Andreevna, who stayed with her until 1956.
Wow.
And helped raise her own two children. And then her father was her only parent from the age of six on. She wouldn't learn until she was 16 that, in fact, her mother had not died of natural causes, as everyone believed, but in fact had committed suicide after being publicly humiliated by Stalin at a state dinner. And so you have to take that and put that in the sort of mental basket of what's to come, and then you have to take the next period as we enter the 30s, now 1932, and realize that she and her father actually had a remarkably tender relationship, though he was often absent and didn't actually live with her and her nurse. They would see each other, and he would write her letters, and she would write him letters, a few of which are actually reproduced verbatim in the book, because I wanted their intimacy and their tenderness and almost innocence to be vivid in the book. And they were, you know, they were truly, the tenderness was not a fiction. Mm-hmm. It was real. And the problem is, of course, that while that was going on, unbeknownst to her at the time, but ultimately known, these same years were the years in which Stalin was the historical monster that we came to know. And so in those same years, in the early 30s, you had the Great Famine, in which they moved all the peasants off their farms and into collective farming, and 5 million people starved to death. It was the Great Purge, the Great Terror, 1937 to 38, you know, 700,000 people were shot. 1.7 million were arrested, and by 38, there were 2 million people in the Gulag. And so, in the end, after Khrushchev's secret speech in 56, and gradually as more came out over the years, and she had to face some of the truth, right, not all of it, there was the knowledge that that tenderness existed over a hideous truth.
And I think that's something that your book delves into, which I think is wonderful too, is that what you might know as truth might not be truth. And what you don't know and you can't believe in. And so similarly with the historical fiction, you know, if you it's a game of what is memory and what are the stories that we tell each other that become fact or history. And so what if this fiction is actually more, and that's what I believe, is actually more truthful to the spirit and the stories of her life than what, you know, someone else's memory or even her own memory. Like you said, she had a tender relationship and a tender memory of her father, but was that the truth of who that man was? Well, for her, that was the truth, but that was kind of a fiction by history standards.
And then she had to, in the end, reckon with that truth that it was a fiction. Right. And so the only thing she ever really had emotionally was the thing that was in some ways most tainted. And also that because of who she was, I mean, she always felt she was in the cage made for her by her father's name, and that it was the thing she could not get away from. At the end of her life, again, not wanting to give too much, but after many journeys, many hard-to-believe journeys, though they were true, she dies in an assisted living facility outside of Spring Green, Wisconsin, a place she has been earlier in her life, in a whole other section of the novel. And then she's come back there. She's living in total anonymity and poverty in a tiny little flat. And nobody knows who she is. She's wearing secondhand clothes. And on a shelf in her little apartment, there are a handful of things that she has carried with her through everything. And it's a picture of her nurse. It is that picture of her mother holding her when she was an infant. It's a picture of the Zubavala, which is the Dhaka where she grew up when she was a little child, when her mother was still alive, and she feels she was happiest. And it's, it's just that. It's like three or four things. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of Elizabeth Taylor movies that she used to watch when she was a little girl in the Kremlin. Mm-hmm. And that's it. You know, she wanted to be anonymous, and yet mm-hmm. even so, she hasn't gotten out of the cage. And I am kind of fascinated, I guess, by people, women particularly, maybe, whose lives were taken from them, whose narratives, if you will, were taken from them. I wrote this novel called The Commoner about 12 years ago, which is inspired by the life of the then current Empress of Japan and the then Crown Princess. As it turns out, the Empress then was the first commoner ever to marry into the imperial family of Japan. And so at the age of 24, she crosses the moat from regular life and literally as a human being almost disappears into the sight of any of the world, never to really truly be seen again. And, you know, it's ironic that 2 weeks ago or less, that emperor abdicated at the age of 85, first emperor to abdicate from the Japanese imperial family in 200 years. So the empress who tells that story, that fictional empress, is no longer the empress. And now the crown princess, who's a character in that novel, is now empress.
Oh my gosh.
And the point was to show this in a way from the perspective of the women in a world in which they had no voice. And now this is happening again in real life.
Yeah.
So, but in Svetlana's case, it's almost as though she never had a chance to have her own narrative because she was born into this and she was always going to be, at some level, the daughter of Stalin. And she tried so hard. You know, sometimes, in very crude, or selfish or narcissistic ways, but nonetheless, she didn't give up. And to think that she made it to 85 in this little place in Wisconsin is, to me, kind of extraordinary.
I'm curious. Well, first off, I applaud you for bringing unsung women's voices to the forefront of our collective imagination
I'm probably
conversation.
Not the first choice that people would point to. I mean, I'm
it doesn't
a,
matter.
Man,
yeah,
man, right?
The
yeah.
fact that you're doing it is incredible and wonderful, and we need more men and women doing that. I am curious, though. Because I think I read in your bio that you're married and you have a son. Is that right?
Yes, I have a 13-year-old.
So yeah. What about women's voices attracts you to telling their unsung story or telling their story that has been put away and, you know, like Svetlana, like the Empress? What draws you?
It's interesting. You know, I may need to lie down on a couch here.
On a swooning couch? Do you need a swooning couch, John?
Yeah, exactly, my therapy couch before I get into this. I mean, it's not something I think about too often in a way, you know, the way we kind of keep a slight distance from the sort of psychological underpinnings of things. But the fact is, I was my whole life, incredibly close to my mom.
That's what I wondered.
Yeah, she passed away 2 years ago, she was really just a remarkable person, but she was married twice, and the second time was to the poet W.S. Merwin, a great poet, who died in March, and just 2 months ago. And they were together for 37 years.
Oh, wow.
And it was really a great love. But my mother was a person who was very literary, and certainly had incredible capacities, I think, towards culture and towards literature in particular. And yet, you know, I think I always thought, well, she needs to do that actively to be happy, to write or to do it herself. But the truth was, is that in her case, I don't think it's true. And I think it was, she turned out to be a person who both gave her life to strong men, but at the same time managed to make an incredibly rich life herself, because she never felt like she gave, she knew who she was. You know,
were you an only child, or did you have siblings?
I have a brother.
Okay.
And
older,
we're very close.
Or younger?
Yes, older brother.
Older brother.
Well, I just saw him in San Francisco.
Oh, fantastic.
But I think if you go through this and you don't have an ego, if you don't have the necessary ego in a way, she didn't have an ego in the sense of needing to claim limelight for herself, but I think she understood where she came from and her own narrative, and ultimately, you know, grasped her life in a way that made her deeply appreciative of it right to the end.
Was
and
she
I
an
don't
artist?
Know, you know, I'm kind of rambling. Yeah, she.
I no, think I
she
love has, hearing about this. Is the interesting
artistic,
stuff. Yeah,
she definitely had an artistic spirit, but I don't think she needed to practice the art. And but she was a huge part in my becoming a writer. She was a huge part, I know, in William Merwin, one of the great poets of, you know, of the last 50, 60 years, in helping him be the artist that he was. There's no way you could imagine his life, in the second half of his life without her. And I'm actually, oddly enough, I have another novel I want to write, actually set in Japan, but I've pushed it back. Right now, I think I'm going to write a short personal memoir about their marriage.
Oh, you should. Because I was going to say, the art of nurturing, that needs to be celebrated more today. Because that is an art and a grace that, you know, I am a feminist. And I am a proud feminist. And so I say this, you know, wanting to clarify that when you're a feminist, it doesn't mean that you don't appreciate that many women want to stay home and take care and be a nurturer. That is their gift. That is their grace. That is the art and the legacy they leave, just as much as being a businesswoman is other people's passion, and being a writer, you know, like myself, that's my passion. There's women need to celebrate each other and support each other in whatever is our wish to be equal. That's what makes us equal with men, is that men are allowed to choose if they want to be the stay-at-home parent or go to work. And that's the equality that, and I think, though, that needs to be celebrated more of the women who, like your mom, who her art and her legacy and what she left behind is you and your brother and her husband. And it's all right there. And that is an extraordinary thing. So I personally would love to read if you wrote it.
Thank you. I've got one reader. So
yes, sign me up, pre-order.
You know, there's this aspect too. I mean, we all have parents, and oftentimes, especially, they pass away, and you think, God, I wish I had recorded that.
Yeah.
You know, my mother or father. I wish I had interviewed them. But I also have this feeling. I'm the literary executive for W.S. Merwin, my stepfather, and I'm looking for, you know, I'm going to go out and find a biographer for him. He was that important a figure. But this is something different, where you realize, at least I do, I realize that someone will come along, they'll do all the homework, they'll find whatever letters, and they'll write the story, the big story. They'll write his story, and they'll capture her part in it. But they will, if I sort of feel as if I don't do this part now, or try to do it anyway, then she'll be lost to time, who she was, you know, who she was.
Her interior, you know that better than anyone.
That's
yep.
And exactly, and I think in a way it's coming off of this novel, The Red Daughter, which I've been working on for years, and then sort of made me more aware of that idea of thinking about voices that get lost.
Yeah.
And then how they might in some way be resurrected. So I agree. I think you put your finger, you definitely got me to talk about my relationship with female characters. But
I,
there you go.
And you know what? Yeah. I had a feeling it had something to do with your with your mom. And I love that idea of writing her story. And I think you would do it brilliantly. So is that the next project on your plate after you book tour?
Yeah, I think as soon as I get home and then I have a film script that's due, and then I'm already reaching out to old friends and people who might have letters of hers and all that, and thinking about, I mean, you know, I'm looking forward to doing the research, I have to say, and to writing it as nonfiction. I just have to find, as we all do, you have to find the form that feels right.
And now, will we be seeing you on television, HBO, or anywhere else soon?
I, in the film business, the last thing of mine that came out was HBO's Wizard of Lies. Mm-hmm. With De Niro and Michelle
Which
Pfeiffer.
Which was fantastic, let me tell you.
But it is, thank you. It's a long time frame. I mean, most things die in Hollywood, and then sometimes things live, but it takes years for them to wind their way to the screen. So I find that I like doing it, and I've been doing it a long time, but you do it, and then you just keep moving.
Right.
If you get stuck on it, you'll be waiting a long time. And, you know, in the meantime, I have my fiction writing and my books, and that's what I'm always trying to get home to.
And
so,
you're the literary director of the Sun Valley Writers Conference. I wanted to make sure that gets out there.
Thank you. I'm meeting with some people out here in LA about that. And it's an amazing literary festival. We're celebrating our 25th anniversary. And, I never imagined it would be going, or I would be still with it after all the years. But it's a great thing to build a community, a literary community, both, in the audience sense, but also the hundreds of amazing writers who we've had over the years. And it's a kind of extended family everywhere you go. And so I find it incredibly invigorating in that way. And we're making a podcast now and, all the things that go into that. So it's about, we're very lucky writers, you and I both, if we get to do different things that form part of a larger fabric of a literary life that we all, we all believe in and are happy and lucky to be a part of.
And that's part of why I love doing this right now, is that I love talking to the community and introducing them to authors that they might not have heard of yet. And I just recently actually moved to Winston-Salem, North Carolina. So, brand new. I lived in Chicago before that and Texas before that. I was kind of a wandering gypsy.
How do you like Winston-Salem?
I absolutely love it. It is beautiful. But part of what makes me love it most is that we have Bookmarks, which is a nonprofit and a bookstore and a book festival that goes on, and they just asked me to join the board. So now, just like you, I'm a part of that sort of building of the literary community. And just like you said, there is nothing greater. It becomes your family. They become your teammates, and you're passionate about giving people the opportunity to explore and to discover new artists for them. Like yourself, and bringing them in. I hope you come here, actually. I'm thinking,
I would happily come. I'm going to festivals, all the summer and fall. And, as a writer, I mean, it's sort of wearing both hats, but I'm a huge supporter of these things. I think, you can be in places where you see the culture being built year by year over time, and it takes on layers of communal history. And then after a certain period, everyone involved can't imagine this place without that event.
Exactly.
And that's part of, that's how the culture gets spread across the country, I think. I think it's really important, especially now.
Yeah, I totally agree. Well, this has been incredible. And We're at the end of our time, and I'm so glad I got to talk to you. I am cheering on the Red Daughter, and I'm cheering on you personally now, John, because you feel like a friend after this.
Thank you. I feel the same way, and I look forward to meeting in person.
Yes, I hope that I am going to be pushing for it in the future to meet you.
I'm going to read your books, too.
Oh, thank you.
Mutually read each other.
I'm honored. Well, we will be in touch then. Thank you, John.
All right.
Again, Zinc Lozenges on book tour. Keep yourself healthy, okay?
Thanks
all right.
So much. Be
Take
well.
Care,
okay.
John. Bye-bye. Okay. You've just listened to Bookmarked with Sarah McCoy on WSNC Radio 90.5, jazz in all its colors. It's been a pleasure. I'll see you all next month.